Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, Bunker Hill, the First American Army, and the Emergence of George Washington, this hour of the program. It is the story, our guest writes, of the First American Army, raised on American soil to defend American interests, made up of men whose sole motivation was the protection of their liberties and their communities, who held together only because they remained steadfastly devoted to a cause that was much bigger than the sum of their individual wants or needs or fears. It is the story of how that army stood its ground in its first real fight, even when pitted against a superior foe, even when led by officers whose courage and sense of duty far outstripped their generalship. It is the story of a new and uncertain George Washington who came to the Army after Bunker Hill and gradually turned it into a force designed to survive the rigors of a prolonged war. And it is also the story, like all great American stories, about ordinary people who, when put to the test, did extraordinary things. Professor Paul Lockhart is our guest this hour, professor of history at Wright State University, where he teaches European and military history and has taught there since 1989. He is also the author of The Drillmaster of Valley Forge. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Paul Lockhart, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to tell you an amusing story. I, at 7:30 last night, was sitting at the kitchen table. Storms, we just stormed all day, big storms all day, reading your book, and the lights flickered. It was all right. At 7:32, the lights came back on. At 7:33, goodbye lights for the next 12 hours. And I got three candles. I had to fumble around in the house, which was totally dark, to find the candles. So I was reading your book by three candles that were lit. Isn't that what a great way? I was just brought right back to the time. I mean, I was, in a sense. I couldn't see other than by candlelight. So it was quite a way to be reading your book. And what a story this is. You know, it is, you're a military historian, but you really weave in all that was going through the minds of these people and the common people and the generals. And it's just remarkable what a group of people who gather together can do. I love the fact that you look at the ordinary people as well and celebrate them, because it was the ordinary people who gathered for this battle.
Oh yes, yes. In fact, you know, the thing that is, it's very easy to be, for example, the American army that forms up after Lexington and Concord and somehow manages to hold together for 2 months before Bunker Hill, is very easy to kind of laugh at their lack of discipline and the fact that so many of them would just wander off from the camps at Cambridge and Roxbury. But having to remember that these men had never actually signed up to be in an army. They came when Massachusetts called them, and at a certain point, they figured they had the right to go home, and they were willing to come back again if called. But it's an utterly amazing group of men, as untrained and undisciplined as they are, that they hold together in those kinds of conditions, and obviously perform beyond creditably at Bunker Hill.
You describe them too as men who are not Americans, really, or even citizens of Massachusetts. They are men of the communities from which they came.
Yes, exactly. You know, although they might have identified themselves in a broader sense as citizens of Massachusetts or New Hampshire or Connecticut or Rhode Island, really their attachment was to their local villages, and it can be, of course, that attachment became very difficult at the time that the Artemus Ward and Joseph Warren are trying to take this group of men and actually form them into an actual army, which means enlisting them for several months, and as soon as the men get put, for example, under the command command of a company commander, of a captain who might not be from their village, they're automatically suspicious of him. They don't know him. You know, they didn't grow up with him, and therefore the notion that it's almost as if they're put under the command of a foreigner as far as they're concerned.
Yeah. You also have, and we'll get to that description of these people who are leading them during the course of this hour on both sides. Early on, you say there is no earthly reason the Battle of Bunker Hill should be as famous as it is. So why is it?
Well, I think it's the mythic quality of the battle. I mean, it's a small battle. It doesn't decide anything. It doesn't end the siege of Boston. It doesn't end the Revolution. It doesn't seriously set one cause back or another. But it does. What it does have is the elements, I think, of the kind of stories that speak to the American character. You know, the ragtags, underfed, undertrained band of Americans put up against superior odds, a professional army that exceeds them in numbers. And, you know, a lot of those mythic qualities have been exaggerated over the years, I think, to make it even more compelling and more dramatic. It fits so well into what I like to think of as American historical mythology, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves about what makes us American.
Right. And it's a good story. So all those people who were gathered were mad about what? Why did they gather 20,000 soldiers in a matter of a week?
Well, their response was initially to the Lexington alarm, in other words, when following Paul Revere's ride, and Thomas Gage sends an expedition to Lexington to arrest a couple of leading patriots or Whigs, whatever you want to call them, and to Concord to seize military stores. The alarm was a summoning of militia throughout the countryside to force the British back, and that's what men responded to. Almost without question, and not just in Massachusetts, but all over New England.
Mm-hmm. And you start early on with a description of Artemus Ward, who's not feeling very well. That's an understatement. Who's on his way back and is really in pain and is noticing that a rebellion was forming.
Yes, yes. Artemus Ward is one of the things that drew me to this book was Artemus Ward.
Really?
Because he himself is a particularly charismatic individual. In fact, in some ways, he's, you know, in terms of personality, he's really kind of, you know, just not very interesting. But in terms of what he contributed and how badly he's been forgotten, how much he's, in fact, become the butt of jokes, Ward did something, if there were nothing else, just what he did in response to the Lexington alarm, having spent several days at the Provincial Congress and being not just sick but doubled over in agony from bladder stones, barely had a chance to rest at home. The Lexington alarm comes, and almost without question, he jumps on his horse, climbs onto his horse, and again in pain, and rides the 40 miles from his home in Shrewsbury to the army at Cambridge in a day by himself. And you know, to me, that speaks volumes about the man's character. And it's that kind of quiet, unassuming, undemanding patriotism that Ward showed that makes it really kind of sad that people like Ward and really so many of the leaders of the army in 1775 have largely been forgotten.
Mm-hmm. You write about the fact that he wasn't particularly a skilled orator. You described his physical appearance, and yet people wanted to hear what he had to say. Why was that?
Well, just because he was those who he came in contact with in Provincial Congress and also at Shrewsbury knew him to be a man of almost unimpeachable honesty and forthright and blunt. Like I said, not a particularly sparkling wit or anything like that, but a man who was solid, dependable, intelligent, and again, above all, honest.
So he's made this trip. He's in pain, and yet he's up and at him the next day.
Yes, yes. And struggling to hold the army together. And he, you know, certainly Washington didn't give him a lot of credit. Washington showed up at the army after Bunker Hill in early July of 1775, seeing that, in his point of view, Ward had done nothing. The army was still undisciplined and poorly fed. But the fact that the army even existed for Washington to show up, let alone that the army existed to fight at Bunker Hill, owes almost entirely to Ward and to his subordinates. And Ward kept the men there. He had to treat them to a certain extent like irresponsible children and men who had never been, most men who had never been in the military before or been away from home for very long, having to remind them constantly the need for certain sanitary and hygienic practices, for example. Ward made sure the men were fed. He kept them together and consequently, the Army remained.
So would you say that it was because of Ward, is this a fair statement, that we had that first American Army?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I don't think there's any question about it. Ward was, I think, had the, although not a great commander, not a great commander in the sense that he was no military genius, and he never claimed to be, a man who was steady and patient and devoted. And without that kind of, especially the patience, without that patience, the Army certainly would not have survived.
Tell me what was going on with the British in Boston, where they were. And then we'll talk about who their leaders were in early June of 1775.
Well, the British Army is entirely in Boston. And, of course, Boston in the summer of 1775 is nothing like it is today. And so modern Boston is really the product of lots of backfilling of shallows in the harbor and the Back Bay. Boston at that point was a really very small peninsula attached to the Massachusetts mainland by a very narrow neck of land. And so it was practically an island. And the entire British Army is basically holed up after Lexington and Concord, holed up inside Boston with fortifications along Boston Neck, the narrow isthmus that connected it to the mainland. That's where it is. Now, it is a, it's one mistake I think that American historians make about the British Army very often is they're so often portrayed as being the finest army in the world.
Yes,
an army
right.
Made up entirely of battle-hardened veterans. And yet, although they were certainly far better trained than American militia was, they're still kids. They're still like pretty much any other army of any age, mm-hmm. made up of guys in their late teens to mid-20s, none of whom, or very, very few of whom, had heard a shot fired in anger. So in a sense, they're almost as raw as the Americans that they'll face at Bunker Hill.
Mm-hmm. And they are led by a guy named Gage, who has a very interesting background, married an American woman, thought of as a fairly reasonable kind of guy, but very hated.
Oh, Gage, it's so easy to feel sorry for Gage. I mean, man, by all accounts, was very, very affable and liked Americans. He didn't like Boston so much. He loved New York, but his dislike for Boston largely came from the way that he was regarded there. But Gage had spent a fair amount of his military career during the French and Indian War in North America. He knew Americans well, and he was married. They mentioned he was married to an American woman. And he had the utmost respect for the military abilities of Americans. Over the past, we historians have liked to see Gage as somebody who just didn't know what had hit him at the time of Lexington and Concord, and still didn't understand it by Bunker Hill. But if you look at his letters, here was a man who, although he despised the Revolution, he fully understood how resourceful Americans were and how tough they were. He understood fully what he was up against. And after Bunker Hill, his letters back to George III and the ministry in London didn't so much say, my God, what have we gotten ourselves into, but rather, I told you so. Because since the fall of 1774, Gage had been telling the authorities back in Britain that this incipient revolution, this coming revolution, was something that had to be taken very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And the Brits kind of ignored him, or?
Yeah. The king ignored him, and as a result, virtually every warning he made, every request he made. One of the requests he made most frequently, for example, was for small boats. He knew that a force in Boston really needed to have amphibious capability, and that meant having small boats. And consistently, they were just his requests were more or less ignored. Gage was left to do what he could with the little that he had on hand, which was not much.
Yeah. It is true that in our mythology, we have created, as you say, the Redcoats as this tremendously much more powerful, well-trained, well-led force. But you write that Britain had, in 1775, a middling, that's an interesting description, a middling sort of army.
Well, it wasn't the best, it wasn't the worst. In some ways, the British Army, compared to other European armies, was actually fairly small. And if you were to ask almost any observer, even British military observers in 1775, who had the best army in Europe, and the answer would almost invariably be Prussia, the army of Frederick the Great. Perhaps after that, France, which probably had the most intellectually active officer corps, for example. Most military thought really was coming from France. Russia and Austria had armies that were much, much larger than Britain's. Britain's army wasn't bad. I don't mean to say that, but it certainly was not the greatest in Europe. One advantage of the British army had that I think we tend to forget, and this is where I come up with where middling came in, was that the British army had almost more experience than any other European army in fighting irregular warfare. From fighting the Native Americans and the French in North America, in the French and Indian War, for example, fighting against the Scots in the 1745 uprising, the British knew how to fight in irregular terrain against an enemy that refused to fight in the European way. And it's something we often don't give the British credit for. You know, the British are, in many histories, are portrayed as steadfastly fighting in this European fashion that European armies themselves fought on a featureless landscape in Europe. And we get the impression that European armies fought on carefully manicured tennis courts and parking lots. I mean, that there's no trees or hills. The British Army was quite adept at fighting this unconventional foe. And oddly enough, one of the biggest stereotypes I found from over the years, the one that the British soldiers intentionally, or British officers intentionally discouraged, aimed fire, and therefore Americans who had great familiarity with firearms were much more superior marksmen. But I find just the opposite is true. Actually, most American soldiers in 1775 had very little familiarity with firearms, didn't rely on them on a day-to-day basis, where the British Army was actually training on a very frequent basis in marksmanship.
Interesting. Tell me, and I'd like for you to do this on both sides, where the British got their officers and their enlisted men, and same with the, well, they didn't call themselves really Americans yet, but same with the Americans.
Where do they get them, you said?
Yeah, where do they come from?
Well, there is a, a similarity in the sense that both draw from what we might call the lower orders of society, but that's different, of course, obviously, from one to the other. In Britain, the army really is a refuge for the desperate. The conditions, the physical conditions of everyday life for a soldier in an 18th century professional army were awful. And because the British Army, like most European armies, was at least in name a volunteer army, you had to be in really bad shape. Financially, you had to be on a run from the law. You had to be seeking refuge from something, in other words, to actually enlist in the army. So we have people, a combination in the British Army of people who again, see military service as an escape from something much worse, or people who have been more or less pressed into service, even if unofficially, people who don't want to be there, in other words. And yet, despite that, there is, as recent scholarship has shown, there's a real bond almost a familial bond between enlisted men and officers in the British Army. And that the spirits are actually, when the British Army is doing fairly well, spirits tend to run pretty high. The soldiers are fairly dedicated to their army and to their king. The officers, mostly lower gentry, people from Britain who had some social standing, but again, not a pleasant lifestyle and a very expensive one. I mean, poor officers who didn't have cash or good connections found that they simply couldn't advance very far. There weren't many opportunities for advancement. Many good officers were stuck at the rank of captain for life just because they lacked the resources to purchase a commission above that. In the American Army, there's not so much of differentiation between those who lead and those who serve. The Army consists, if you can call it that, consists of farmers, of tradesmen, of day laborers, of school teachers, a good cross-section of rural New England society in 1775. And their officers might be slightly better off than the men they lead, but only by degrees. There's not a huge social gulf. And that's one of the reasons that discipline is so difficult to enforce in the American Army, is that the soldiers, the men, have a very difficult time accepting that one of them part of, you know, is somehow somebody who's not really their social better is someone they have to listen to, that they have to obey unquestioningly. But again, this, you know, the American Army is different, in partly because American society is different, and because these are men who have, in large part, responded to a call quite willingly.
Mm-hmm. And where's George Washington during all of this?
Well, George Washington is, after the Lexington alarm, he's getting ready to leave Mount Vernon and go to Philadelphia to attend the Second Continental Congress. And really right around the time of the battle, just before the Battle of Bunker Hill, that Washington was, in fact, finally appointed Commander-in-Chief by the Continental Congress. He was on his way to assume command in Cambridge. He was actually in New York City when he got the word of the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Oh, and what did he think of it?
Well, he was both scared, as he should have been, that the that hostilities had truly broken out, and on the other hand, very encouraged, because although Bunker Hill was a defeat, Massachusetts did its best to put a good spin on the battle. But although it was a defeat, in the sense that the British forced the Americans from their fortifications and held the ground, it showed that Americans could actually stand up to the British. And Washington already suspected this, but this was confirmation for him, and as he knew, it would be a boost to American self-confidence.
And was there any hope at this time that there could be some kind of reconciliation with the British? Or was
Yes, very much so. Now, the Battle of Bunker Hill will certainly take away a fair amount of that. But certainly in Continental Congress, there are a good number of people who, although they sympathized with Massachusetts and saw the necessity for some kind of action, still hoped that maybe the colonists could teach England a lesson, or at least show the king, show George III, the gravity of the offenses that they felt had been perpetrated against them. So there's still a great deal of hope amongst some in Congress that even with Bunker Hill, that this isn't the end. But Bunker Hill certainly seems to make that possibility of a peaceful reconciliation a lot more distant.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking with the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, Bunker Hill, the First American Army, and the Emergence of George Washington. Our guest is Professor Paul Lockhart, professor of history at Wright State University, where he teaches European and military history. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, in case you would like to use that as your form of communication, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Paul Lockhart, author of The Whites of Their Eyes, our guest. He's also author of The Drill Master of Valley Forge. We go to phone calls now. One line is open if you'd like to grab it, 800-486-8655. Let's start with Eric in Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I joined the program a little late, but I have a question. I hope you haven't covered it yet. I think that maybe one of the myths about the Revolutionary War that I don't know if we're taught directly or sort of led to believe, but there really weren't that many casualties on either side. I've seen estimates as high as 25,000 and as low as 12 on the American side. And I'm just wondering if your guest could comment on that, please.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the American Revolution is a fairly, especially in terms of battlefield casualties, is relatively low. And as in most pre-modern wars, the death toll from disease was and from accidents was much higher than on the battlefield. And even Bunker Hill, which is very often presented as being kind of a crude slaughter, the casualties on the British side were higher than we would see them in any other battle of the war. I mean, close to 40%. But you have to keep in mind Bunker Hill was a fairly small battle, and that was actually par for the course, really, for battles in the middle of the 18th century. But yeah, the American Revolution, although the Revolution itself lasts 8 years, has relatively few pitched battles, and most of them are pretty small. Bunker Hill just being kind of the smallest of the well-known ones. So it is a war that is not especially bloody, especially within the context of 18th century warfare.
40% casualties, though, must have been pretty alarming to the British.
Yes and no. It is certainly British officers expressed a great deal of shock afterwards, and it is certainly the highest loss of life among the British officers, and casualties were disproportionately high amongst the officers. But again, keeping in mind, it was heavier than anything the British had experienced probably in the past century. Within a couple of decades, the battles between the Prussians and the Russians, or Prussians and the Austrians in the Seven Years' War, 40% was pretty normal, actually. 18th century warfare is a lot bloodier than people think. Mm-hmm. But the real shock that when the British officers expressed shock after the battle wasn't so much that the high casualty rate. It was the high casualty rate among officers, and second, the failure of the enlisted men to do what they were told. And this is what really bothered the British, and really is the key to the high casualties amongst the British, to the fact that the army simply did not do what it was supposed to do.
What was it supposed to do?
Well, it was supposed to attack with a bayonet. Now, the attacks on Breed's Hill and the other fortifications are very often presented mistakenly as being a series of suicidal frontal assaults. It's not what the British commander William Howe intended. He intended what they call a turning movement, which is making a feint against the main enemy line and then coming crashing down on an exposed enemy flank and try to roll them up that way. That didn't work, and the attack, first attack, faltered, regrouped on its own, went up again, and also failed. Then Howe ordered a second attack. The Americans saw this as three attacks. The British actually only ordered two. The reason that these failed, wasn't because bayonet charges didn't work. Actually, 18th century tacticians knew very well that bayonet charges worked, and they worked well. They demanded, however, a lot from their troops, because a successful bayonet charge required not stopping. And this is exactly what we see at Bunker Hill. It's exactly what we see in a lot of battles of the American Civil War, that men who are not especially trained or battle-hardened, when going up in an advance against an enemy, in this case a fortified enemy, an entrenched enemy, will tend to stop once they're fired upon and fire back. And very often they'll lose their formations. It'll cluster together in big clumps, largely for security, even though it's counter-rational, and fire back. Bayonet charges worked if the men didn't stop, that they kept moving, especially moving quickly in the danger zone where musketry was most deadly. Because once you got a fair number of troops up against the enemy in very close range with bayonets leveled, then the enemy would almost invariably break and run. As military theorists knew very, very well, very, very brave troops could easily stand up under heavy musketry, under heavy gunfire. That they could tolerate. The sight of a naked bayonet being level at their chest for only a few feet away, however, was too much for almost any man to take.
Mm. Where do we get this? It's the title of your book, Holding Fire Until You See the Whites of Their Eyes.
Well, the notion is that, of course, a smoothbore musket, such as Americans and the British both used. Americans, contrary to a lot of popular belief, had absolutely no rifles at Bunker Hill, just smoothbore muskets. They're short-range weapons. They're really, although they might have an extreme range of well over 200 yards, their effective range is really under 100 yards, and especially under 50 yards, where they're most devastating. The greatest number of shots are going to hit if you wait till the enemy is closest. But in particular was the moral quality of a volley at close range, because if all the men are able to hold their fire, so let me call fire discipline, until the last possible moment, until the enemy is almost on top of them, and let loose with a volley, the effect of having a rank or even two ranks of men seemingly melt into the ground for that devastating fire was, again, it would be a huge blow to enemy morale and likely to send survivors scattering for the rear.
Mm. Thanks, Eric, for the call. Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, I want to talk about Washington's treatment of his prisoners that he took, prisoners of war. And by the way, the British were calling our Minutemen terrorists. They were saying things like they're not wearing uniforms, they're shooting from behind the trees, they're using guerrilla tactics. So your statement earlier that the British were so adept at this, well, that's funny. In the world of in the papers and whatever, at that time, the British were complaining that we were terrorists for not wearing uniforms, for using guerrilla tactics. So that would go counter to your argument that they were better than we were in the woods, let's say. And saying that our men couldn't shoot, most colonialists had to shoot often to provide their own dinner, sir. Have you ever tried to shoot a squirrel from a tree?
Professor Lockhart.
Okay, I'll address that in several points. First of all, as to language calling Americans terrorists, it tended to be political hyperbole. British officers didn't. In fact, generally speaking, look at the writings of British officers, although occasionally they complained about the tactics of the Americans. By and large, especially senior officers like Howe and Gage, who had been in the French and Indian War, were perfectly familiar with these tactics. I didn't argue that they were better at them than Americans were. I simply argued that they were very familiar with them. As to the marksmanship thing, yes, some colonials were, in fact, very familiar with firearms on the frontier. Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Connecticut were no longer the frontier, and men didn't rely anymore on weapons to provide their dinners. They relied on farming. These are men who had, in many cases, and it's well tested in the documentary record, might have owned firearms, but had very little familiarity with them. In fact, it's clear from the writings of officers in the army around Boston in 1775 that the men, in many cases, had hardly ever fired a musket before. In many cases, one of the most common accidents in the camp of the army at Cambridge and Roxbury came from men who were accidentally discharging muskets in camp because they didn't know how to use them. So, no, I wouldn't accept that argument for the army, certainly not for the army around Boston in 1775, because these were men who did not rely on firearms for their everyday lives.
Steve has a question on these lines from Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Hi. You answered part of the question about your documentation for your statement of the poor quality of marksmanship. One thing you said, though, the British were losing a lot of officers. I assume they were being killed by very accurate marksmen. And the other thing that I'm aware of is that when the Lexington and Concord battle was forming, they wanted to call up 1,000 militiamen. They had so many volunteers. The officer had a fence post put in the ground 200 yards out. Within 2 hours, they were able to form up 1,000 people that could hit that 200-yard target. And I do know that the militias apparently had perhaps some extra experience with marksmanship than the civilian recruits out of the cities and more urbanized areas that were farming. I think maybe there's a difference between the marksmanship among the militia and the standing army. And a second quick question, what's your take on Mrs. Gage? Was she the one that let the colonists know about General Gage's troop movements?
Okay, well, to delay any confusion, first of all, understand I'm talking about the army outside of Boston in 1775. I've heard that story about the firing at 200 yards. I'm pretty sure it's apocryphal. In fact, from several sources, it's pretty obvious that it is apocryphal. First of all, the musket, simply whose hands it was in, a musket hitting a specific mark at 200 yards is virtually impossible, even with a well-trained man. Rifles are unknown in New England, just about unknown in New England. Again, I'm going here by the sources themselves, which show that American soldiers outside Boston in 1775 had very little familiarity with firearms. We're not talking about frontiersmen from Virginia or Pennsylvania, but ordinary New England farmers. As to the heavy death toll among British officers, this wasn't a result of marksmanship, and the Americans understood this themselves. It was because the British officers were exposing themselves far more so than they should have been done. In many cases, for example, in the final assault on the Breed's Hill Redoubt, British officers were trying to drag their men, who were in some cases cowering against the berm of the redoubt, up to charge over the fort at the Americans. British officers, in other words, were the only ones who were standing up. In many cases, were the high loss of life among them comes from that, not so much from superior marksmanship, but just from the fact that they were the ones who were most exposed.
Let's go to some more of the interesting people here. Until his death, you write, at Bunker Hill on June 17, 1775, the most influential revolutionary leader in Massachusetts, Dr. Joseph Warren.
Yes, yes, there's no doubt about it. Warren is, I think, the most, Warren might be the most unjustly forgotten, Artemus Warren might be the most unjustly forgotten military figure. Warren, I think, is the most unjustly forgotten founding father. This is a man who was president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, the leader of the Committee of Safety, commissioned a major general in the Massachusetts militia right before the Battle of Bunker Hill. And had his hand everywhere. And the thing that's interesting, in Massachusetts, where there was a great deal of distrust of personable, charismatic leaders and a fear of tyranny, among other things, Warren was trusted by everyone. He seemed to be involved everywhere at once. In several of the skirmishes that take place, like at Grape Island and Noddle's Island before Bunker Hill, he was at all of them. Not the man in command, he just wanted to be involved. It's his energy, his personality, the fact that he can make, that he can get the generals and the Congress and the Committee of Safety all to get along, and his ability to bring in the other New England colonies into the fight. That really assured, along with Ward's leadership in the camps, really assured American success.
So why did we forget him? Because he died so early in the battle?
Exactly, because he died early. Mm-hmm. And there were some attempts to memorialize him. He was a Freemason, and the Masons in Boston tried their best to make sure that he was properly memorialized. The first monument at Bunker Hill was, in fact, a monument to Joseph Warren. But, yeah, he was shot at Bunker Hill on his way out of the redoubt. And although I would argue in the politics of the first 2 months of the Revolution, Warren was more important, more influential than, say, John Hancock or Sam Adams, at least in the early months of 75. The fact that he died so early kind of, well, that ends it, obviously.
Right. Yeah. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Loving this program.
Good.
As always. My question involves the colonists' relationship with the British to this extent. And you've mentioned a couple times now getting the attention of the king. And I think it really culminates when the Declaration of Independence cites this bill, this whole range of injustices all being perpetrated on the colonists by the king. But isn't it the fact that the Glorious Revolution had happened, almost a century previous? And in fact, they weren't dealing with a king, an absolute dictator of a king. They were dealing with an elected parliament and prime ministers, much as, not probably to the degree that George III is a figurehead, such as Elizabeth II is right now. But really, doesn't it seem odd to you that everything would be laid at the foot of this monarch, as if he were in fact this absolute dictator?
I wouldn't say it's odd. It's kind of in keeping with 18th century political discourse. Initially, though, the blame isn't laid with George III. There's something very, very medieval, in some cases, about the discourse of the early revolutionaries, who don't depict their problems as being those brought about by a wicked or tyrannical king, but rather a king who was unduly influenced by wicked or tyrannical advisors. So George III, and if you see this in revolutions in Europe, for example, and uprisings in Europe throughout the Middle Ages and the early modern period, the notion that the king is a protector of the common people, however he can be unduly influenced by wicked ministers. And that's initially the language that the rebellious colonials take. But certainly George III puts himself up for language aimed directly at him and showing him to be a tyrant, because the obduracy of the British in refusing to negotiate with the colonists, and what makes it so difficult to work with the British, in large part, comes from George III's conviction that the revolution must simply be crushed. Although many of his generals, of course, are opposed to it, as seeing it as an almost unwinnable war.
May I just do a quick follow up here?
Of course. Sure.
A couple of things that you've been talking about today have really put in mind, to me anyway, these ragtag groups who are out in the streets and don't really know what they're doing, and this whole, like you just said, about the appeal to the king on the basis of having bad ministers and advisors. Doesn't this just seem like eerily like the Middle East right now?
Yes, and I've had that brought up to me before. It is eerily like it. And I think, of course, the saving grace that American colonists have, that the revolutionaries in the Middle East do not have, is a somewhat more primitive technology and slower communication, which certainly worked to the benefit of American rebels in 1775.
Okay, thanks again so very much.
Yeah, thanks, Scott, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, Bunker Hill, the First American Army, and the Emergence of George Washington. Paul Lockhart is with us, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Craig in Waukesha. Hi, Craig.
Hey, how you doing? Just for what it's worth, I'm actually descended from two people who fought in that battle. One of his name was Stevens, and he was in James Reed's 3rd New Hampshire Regiment.
Oh, my.
And another one named Foster, who was in Nixon's regiment from Massachusetts. And he was actually related to Artemus Ward. But my main point was the fact that there were African-Americans who fought in the battle, including the one who is allegedly have killed Major John Pitcairn of the Royal Marines. I just wonder if your guests would like to touch on African-Americans that participated in the battle. Thank you. I'll take my comment off
Thank
here.
You. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, the Army is one of the surprising things about I think, to those unfamiliar with the early campaigns of the Revolution, is how diverse this first American Army is. I mean, that's something that will fluctuate over time. But although the Massachusetts Provincial Congress early on balked at the idea of enlisting slaves, they had no problem with enlisting free African-American men. And so we know the numbers are difficult to ascertain for the Army as a whole, in part because the personnel records are not all that great, and second, because the presence of free black men in the Army was apparently something that didn't strike anybody as really unusual, which is that strikes me as unusual in itself. But at the Battle of Bunker Hill, we're reasonably certain there were at least 88 African-American men and at least 15 Native American men within the battle itself. That doesn't count the other portions of the Army, for example, at Roxbury that didn't engage in the fighting.
Thanks very much for your call. We go next to David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Hello. When you mentioned Warren Bunker Hill, do you know that he's related to Johias Warren? That I don't know, great grandson. I'm not sure what the relation is, but he was involved in the anarchist utopia movement. He started several communities. New Harmony, I think, was one. He also worked, I guess, with Oneida, where Oneida Civil War comes from. I just thought that might be interesting for you.
Thanks for pointing out. I didn't realize that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. You start the book, and I wonder why you start this way, although it's a fascinating story, with 50 years after Bunker Hill, Boston, Massachusetts, 1825, and this very interesting gathering of people to commemorate the 50th anniversary, and particularly to place an enduring memorial to those who died atop Reed's Hill in 1775, Daniel Webster among them. Why do you start the book there?
Well, I guess part of it was I was trying to understand for myself why it was that Bunker Hill is so well known. As somebody who's taught college freshmen for 22 years in all sorts of courses, one thing I got to know, and I think I brought this up in the preface in the prologue, was that Bunker Hill is, one of the two or three or maybe four battles in American history that has enjoyed instant name recognition with virtually anyone, along with D-Day, Gettysburg, and maybe the Alamo. That I know from experience and from that of experience of my colleagues that most students can at least identify Bunker Hill as having been a battle, even if they can't identify it with the Revolution. They know it was a battle. And compared to other Revolutionary War battles that don't receive anything like that name recognition, I mean, not even Yorktown, I think, has the same fame, even though it's far more important. I'd say the same thing for that matter, for Germantown or Brandywine or Saratoga or Monmouth. But Bunker Hill despite the fact that it's not very big and really not all that significant tactically or strategically, is so well known. And it was, you know, clear part of it was this mythic element to the battle, that it is the great American battle, as I put it, but also that it is it was memorialized early on, and whether it was a recognition of that mythic quality or whether Massachusetts and the rest of the New England states wanted to memorialize their participation in the Revolution, and after all, Bunker Hill being probably the most, probably the biggest battle fought in Massachusetts itself. It was that early memorialization, long before there was a battlefield preservation movement, long before there were Revolutionary War buffs, that really caught my interest.
Mm.
And the fact, too, that the vast difference between Boston in 1825 and Boston in 1775, Boston in 1775 would have been unrecognizable to somebody in 1825.
And yet you also write, though, I think you wrote this, unless somebody else wrote this about your book. I can't tell for sure. That when Howe replaced Gage as the military commander in America, the events of Bunker Hill will continue to haunt him, and would time and time again fail to follow up a victory over the Americans.
Well, yeah, but you may recall I also kind of dismissed that to a certain extent. And it's partly because my own, and I realize that there are people already going, and I know full well there are people who disagree with me on this, that Howe was very conservative about his approach to war, but also very diffident about his participation in it from the very beginning. I don't quite agree with the literature that says, or the historians that argue that Howe did something big and bold at Bunker Hill, largely out of some contempt that he supposedly had for Americans, and then was so cowed by what happened that he became overly cautious later in his career. And it's an example of what historians sometimes call post hoc propter hoc, after this because of this. It's an error that because something happens after something else, that means it happens because of that.
Right.
In short, that Howe becomes cautious because of Bunker Hill. I don't think there's the only reason that idea has held on in the literature is because it just keeps getting repeated. There's no evidence to support that. Howe doesn't say anything to support that. I would argue that his attack at Bunker Hill was in itself actually a fairly cautious move that went awry.
Hmm. Randy in Key Wascom, hi.
Hello. I was listening, and there's something Washington did that bears out the fact that there were a lot of poor marksmen in the Continental Army. The first uniform he used was the linen hunting frock, and part of it was cloth, but the other part was it kind of gave the British the idea that there were a lot more marksmen, because they realized early on that these frontiersmen in the hunting frocks could shoot.
Exactly. Yeah, and the hunting frock gives the impression, you're right, of being a frontiersman. Yes.
And what is that hunting frock? Can you tell me more about that?
Well, basically, a loose garment that was peculiar to the colonies, really, in the 18th century, and exists with some changes into the beginning of the 19th. A fairly loose hanging garment, very plain, usually with fringed edges, largely around the collar and cuffs and over the body, but very plain, usually in a dull or natural or earth tone. It's kind of part of the standard clothing, if you will, of people who lived in the backwoods.
How about
practical hunting garment?
How about all of those people who heard the drum and gathered to fight? I'm always interested because I can't quite fathom this. What made them so brave?
You're talking about actually in battle or in... I'm not following you entirely.
Well, it just made them answer the call and decide they were going to risk their lives.
Well, part of it is, specifically with the Americans,
yeah.
Part of it is that... I don't think, again, a situation like this, and I think we see this at the beginning of many wars in our history, many wars in the history of the Western world, that young men don't always think of the consequences when they sign up for military service, that there is the spirit of adventure, of getting out into the bigger world, of doing something that matters, or just getting away from the restrictions of living at home. There's that. It's not always bravery and always dedication to the cause, although those things may go hand in hand. Part of it is too that these are very tightly knit communities, and when there is already a pervasive feeling that Britain has wronged the colonies, and the colonies have to stand up for their liberties and their rights. When that is so pervasive, and when the communities are that tightly knit, if somebody goes, everybody's going to go. I mean, it's not entirely individual acts of bravery so much as there is a groundswell, and to a certain extent, a kind of a groupthink.
Yeah, we have about 45 seconds left. Randy, hi. Oh no, we got Randy already, so we don't have time for another caller. I'm sorry. You're a heck of a writer. Thanks so much for and really know your material. You make us all want to go learn more about Bunker Hill and other battles and immerse ourselves in the Revolutionary War. It was good. Well, thank you. Well,
thank you so much.
Our guest this hour of the program, the author of The Whites of Their Eyes, Bunker Hill, the First American Army, and the Emergence of George Washington. Paul Lockhart is a professor of history at Wright State University. He teaches European and military history. He's also the author of The Drill Master of Valley Forge. And it really is an excellent book. Well, that takes care of this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Tomorrow, President speaking on Afghanistan. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Afghanistan from different kinds of perspectives, environmentalism in Afghanistan with somebody from the UN, and Chip Duncan, who's a filmmaker from the Milwaukee area who just returned from Afghanistan. Also, the marvelous exhibit on China at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Thanks for listening.